I'm here today with Richard Sylvester from Inet. Richard, you are a non-duality speaker. So the first question kind of forms itself, what is non-duality?
I think the easiest way to describe non-duality, or the most basic aspect of it to describe first, is that seeing non-duality is seeing that there is no self. I mean, that is the absolutely most basic and simple way of putting it. It's seeing that this, if you like, what appears to be a person with the things that we associate with that, like a life which the person lives, with responsibility and autonomy and choice and the ability to make it a good life or not a good life, that is all seen through. It's seeing that what this is actually is empty. And when I hold meetings about this, I often start by saying that, you know, the core message of this, the core communication is there is no self. It's as simple as that. And I would suggest that that's the heart of all mystical communication, wherever we find it, whether we find it in the yogic tradition, the Buddhist tradition, in Taoism, it's there in the Christian tradition, it's there, of course, in the Sufi tradition, wherever mystics have spoken, in a way, the only thing that they have to say, the only thing any mystic really has to say, is there is no self. And anything else that we say, or anything else that we talk about, flows out of that core statement, or if you like, that core seeing. So the suggestion from here is that can be directly seen.
Well, so everything is just happening by itself, as could we say that like this?
Absolutely, yeah. Everything is happening of its own accord. Absolutely. This is, we could say, is arising. This is arising out of emptiness. It's falling back into emptiness. We could say this is non-duality or oneness manifesting as two-ness, manifesting as duality or everything. And it happens of its own accord. And one of the things that happens is that the individual, the person, tends to develop a sense of separation in which they feel that they are in control of something called their life and that they are doing it themselves. A metaphor I often use is that the self, or what sometimes people call the ego, it's like, if you imagine, it's like the managing director of an enormous organization, and it sits behind a huge and very, very important desk.
Yeah.
And this desk is covered with very important looking levers and equally important looking buttons, and the self sits there all day and it pulls levers and it pushes buttons
to make things happen
out there, and it goes, see, I've made that happen, and the joke is that not one of those levers or buttons is attached to anything, none of them do anything. And something that's often reported when the self is seen through, not always, but quite often, there's quite a lot of laughter when the self is seen through, and that's partly what that laughter is about. It's seen to be such a joke that for maybe all those years, I felt myself to be sitting behind a desk making things happen, and all the time that was all just a play. It was all simply empty.
There's a common feeling, like, for example, I control my arm, I am the one who is directing the arm left, because, left, okay, then it's turned left, right, and it's turned right, and it absolutely feels like, this is me and I'm controlling it. And that's an illusion?
It absolutely feels like that until it stops feeling like that. And something that's quite interesting is happening now, is happening very recently, So we could say that in the story of time, mystics have said over and over again that that is, let's call it an illusion, that's not quite the right word, but let's call it an illusion, that no one was ever controlling this arm. And of course what's happening recently at the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century, is that neuroscience is now confirming that. Neuroscience is now saying exactly the same thing.
Neuroscience,
yes, the science.
They found out that the brain is making the decision before the consciousness, before it arises in consciousness.
Exactly. So not all neuroscience and not all psychologists and philosophers who are influenced by that would say this, but many of them would now say, would now acknowledge, there is no chance of there being a central self with autonomy who exercises choice.
Even within the story with modern scientists now, and science now.
Yeah. As this hand goes out to pick up this cup of tea, what neuroscience tells us is that all of the, if you like, the physical operations attendant on that, they all start happening before the conscious mind decides, oh, I think I'll pick up the cup of tea and have a sip.
So we are kind of just watching and like in a 3D cinema where everything moves and you see the screen and you think you actually are, I don't know, in a roller coaster or something like that, you know, these 4D cinemas where everything moves and it just feels that way, that you are actually in a roller coaster, but it's just a picture on the screen and it's a machine that's moving and giving you the feeling that it's happening, and this is actually what life is.
Yeah, there are some very good metaphors for trying to explain this, and the traditional metaphor, which is perhaps most often used, is to compare this to a nighttime dream, because everyone's had the experience of nighttime dreams, and in a nighttime dream all sorts of things happen, all sorts of events occur, and they happen in space and time, and the moment we wake up in the morning we know that none of it was real.
Yes.
And so
feels real within the dream.
And so a frequently used metaphor for this traditionally has been to call this the waking dream. Now I think an equally good metaphor, or a very good metaphor, is the metaphor of a cinema film, which you've just referred to. I'm sure if they had cinemas 4,000 years ago in the Vedantic era, or 3,000 years ago, whenever it was, I'm sure they would have used the metaphor of a cinema film, because it's the same thing. It seems so real. You know, we watch a film and if we're drawn into it, it's so real. There are people involved, they have emotions, there's action, there might be death, there might be birth, there's space and time, and none of it is real. It's all simply a play of light.
But wait a second.
If you say,
this is all like a cinema, and the joke is in within the story, if this is all a waking dream, one part of the waking dream is that people decide to make movies and to create a fake reality, and everything of that happens in already a fake reality.
You could
Isn't
say
that. Isn't that totally absurd?
You could say that it's totally absurd, and again, I refer to the fact it doesn't always happen, but when this is, if this is suddenly seen, or if this is suddenly seen through, there are quite a lot of reports of a lot of laughter. Not always, but there's often a lot of laughter. Because it is so absurd, and the kind of the core of that absurdity is that for 20, 30, 40, 50, maybe 60 years, this thought that it was solid and it was doing stuff and that it had a separate existence, and it's such a joke to suddenly see through that, to suddenly see that none of that ever applied, none of that was ever the case. And so sometimes there's a lot of laughter.
So you can't teach me that. I can't come to you and you offer me some techniques or something like that, where I can, for example, Ramana Maharshi's popular question, "Who are you?" or "Who am I?" and then also some techniques like trying to choose something and look, do I make the choice? And easily it is seen if there's look that choice and thought are not created by oneself. Couldn't you call these techniques for that?
Well, the seeker is always going to look for something to do. That's what it means to be a seeker. So the seeker is going to find something to do, some practice to do. It might be mindfulness, it might be self-inquiry that you've just referred to, it might be any one of a huge variety of techniques. It's kind of inevitable. The seeker is desperate to find and is desperate to feel that there is some practice that will enable them to find. All I can really say sitting here is that when the seeker is seen through, it's seen that there was nobody who was ever looking, and there was nobody who could, there was nobody who could ever find. The point about, I mean, I don't know a great deal about self-inquiry, so I won't say very much about it, but the simple thing that I will say, one of the things is that the mind gets hold of the idea that, let's call it liberation, which is not a good word, but never mind, liberation has certain characteristics. I mean, it doesn't actually. You could say liberation has all characteristics, yeah, but the mind thinks it has certain characteristics. Yeah. For example, the mind thinks that liberation has the characteristic of a quiet mind. And so the person says, the seeker says, ah, if I quieten my mind, then that will bring me closer to liberation. But it's ridiculous. It's kind of confusing, if you like, confusing cause and effect. Quietening my mind will not bring me closer to liberation. But if liberation is seen, it's possible, although not certain, that a quieter mind might then result.
Yeah.
And the thing about, the one thing I would say about self-inquiry, it seems to me, and I've never practiced self-inquiry, but the problem seems to me that as long as there is someone self-inquiring, in other words, as long as there is someone asking themselves who they are, then the person or the sense of separation is there. It's kind of hopeless.
It empowers even the sense of someone who is
searching. It may do. It may do. Yeah. And if the sense of separation has fallen away, then there's no need to ask, who am I? Because it's known.
So this falling away of the person that you've mentioned a few times now is something that could never be done by a person.
Exactly.
By let's just say that which says I can do something.
Exactly.
It's
the kind of ultimate folly, but it's also a very understandable folly. Absolutely, because the person who feels separate and who feels that they can do something to end their separation is a false person anyway. I wanted to say then it's just an idea, but of course it's more than an idea. I mean,
yeah,
the sense of separation,
energy,
is kind of real energy. It's an energy of contraction.
Yes.
But that which, if you like, holds that energy of contraction is a non-existent person. So it's like, you know, an unreal person is trying to destroy itself or trying to end itself. And it is kind of absurd. I mean, the ultimate, as I understand it, the ultimate point, for example, with self-inquiry, you know, I ask myself who I am, and as I peel away the different layers of the self, if you like, the different layers of the person, eventually I will discover, you know, the emptiness which is at the core of this, you know, that there is no one at the core. But the trouble is, it's a person discovering that they're empty, then it's just kind of, It's just knowledge. Knowledge doesn't really have any bearing here. You know, so a person who fully understands that they are not a person still feels like a person.
Oh.
And if the person has disappeared anyway, then there's no need to self-inquire. There's no need to look for the emptiness at the core, because that's already seen.
It's also not something you can particularly do anything with, is knowing, I'd say. Like it's if there's known that there's that free will is an illusion.
The question of whether to practice or whether not to practice is completely irrelevant anyway. Exactly, because free will is an illusion. What happens simply happens. So if there's an energy to do a practice, that will happen. If there's no energy to do a practice, then it won't happen. And it happens, if you like, in spite of who we think we are.
Okay.
So there's nothing wrong with practice, and there's nothing right with practice. Practice is simply practice. And if it happens, it happens, and when it stops happening, it will no longer happen.
But it can bring anyone to anywhere, it's just something that happens.
Well, it can't bring anyone to the seeing that there is no one. Some practices have psychological and emotional effects. And some of those psychological and emotional effects may be positive and some of them may be negative.
Yeah.
So we could say that on the level of the dream of life, practices do have an effect.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
But they're not going to reveal the person to be unreal.
Okay. I have a question about this free will is an illusion issue.
Okay.
When I find myself in the situation that other people act very judgmental upon a person I love because that one has acted in a hurtful way, the urge to tell them that he or she couldn't have acted differently, arises, you know, because free will is an illusion. So, but it's no use because no one usually believes that. So, do you know that situation? Can you share your thoughts on seeing that free will is an illusion while most people don't? Or whole society is based upon the belief in free will?
Yes, our whole society is, but there is a kind of societal collusion, you could say, which starts when children are very young to encourage us in our sense of separation and in our sense that we are a person with a life that we have responsibility for and we have free will to exercise over that. I don't know what I can say about that other than when it's seen through, it's seen through. And of course, as we've already alluded to, there are neuroscientists, philosophers and psychologists who are now recognising, let's say, the illusion of free will, not necessarily because they've seen through it in the sense we're talking about it here, but because they're coming to it from a different angle. To be honest, I mean, I'm not particularly concerned on like the mass effects on society, for example. Some people are interested in this. What would be the mass effects on society if free will was recognised to be the illusion that it really is? And I'm not particularly interested in that question, but on the other hand, I've given it a little bit of thought, and my suspicion is that the effects would probably be wholly beneficial. And I don't usually recommend the books of another writer. Why should I? But on this one occasion I will. There's an American called Sam Harris who has...
I heard some of his talks on free will and he was very speaking
he's very good.
To a general audience.
Yeah. Well, he's written a very short book called Free Will.
Very short.
And it's only about 80 pages and he comes from a background of neuroscience and a background of Zen as well, and martial arts. I believe Zen, definitely martial arts, and I think meditation as well. So he comes from both backgrounds. And I would say that that little book, Free Will by Sam Harris, is the best thing about free will I've ever read. A little Freudian slip there, you see, because obviously I really wish that I had written it.
Yes.
I would say it's the best. It's the best little book on free will I've ever read. Yes, if I just add something to what I was saying before, I would say one of the things to remember about non-duality, about what we're talking about, is it's completely non-instrumental in both senses. And what I mean by that is you can't use anything to reach it, as it were, what we were talking about practices such as self-inquiry and so forth. You can't use something instrumentally in order to, as it were, attain the seeing of non-duality. But also, it's non-instrumental in the other sense, in that if liberation is seen, or if non-duality or the emptiness of the self is seen, you can't then use that for anything. You know, it doesn't. It's not something that you can then, as it were, benefit from. That a person can benefit from, because the person isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
So all we could really say about it is, it is. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
It can't be used for anything, and we can't use anything to get to it. And that, for the mind, is extremely frustrating.
Yes.
I mean, before we started this interview, when we were chatting a little bit beforehand, you mentioned the fact that some people can get pretty angry when they hear about non-duality. There are all sorts of possible reactions to hearing about non-duality, and anger is a fairly common one. And I think that's partly because the mind finds the communication of non-duality extremely frustrating. I mean, it just challenges everything that the mind believes in and everything that the mind tends to think.
Okay, well, how did you become a spiritual seeker anyway, and why? I mean, it's a story, apparently, but maybe you'd like to talk about it?
I'll talk about it a little bit. I mean, it is a story, as you say. It's not important, you know, everybody, you know, what happens for each individual is different, and it's simply what happens for them. But for me, very briefly, I think what brought me to spiritual seeking is what brings a lot of people to spiritual seeking, which is a certain feeling of despair in life.
Despair?
Yeah. I think a lot of people, many of the aspects of life which we're taught to consider important may be working well. You know, you may have a good job, you may be earning enough money, you may have your health, you may have a partner, you know, you may be achieving all sorts of things, and yet many people in that situation still feel a kind of a level of, I'm going to call it despair, some people might call it emptiness, the existentialists might call it angst. And I think, as with many, many other individuals, that's probably what started me looking to find fulfillment somewhere other than the obvious places to find fulfillment.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Simple as that.
I know a spiritual seeker who said everything was there, but something was missing. That was the quote of it.
Of course, the irony is, I would say, is that eventually what you discover is that everything is there and you feel that something is missing. But of course, the irony is actually that there is something that's not missing that in a way should be, you know. Does that make sense? Well, the person is present, and the person being present messes everything up in a way.
Yeah, like I have to control my life, and I'm not supposed to make bad decision or to,
So the joke is that we feel we have to find something to make life complete.
Yeah.
But of course, really, what has to happen is that we have to lose something to make life complete. We have to lose ourselves, and unfortunately, we can't do anything about that. But it can happen.
Well, as much as I know, you had two profound awakening experiences. We may call it that. One in a train station and one in a clothes shop, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
It's a story. Can you describe what happened at each experiences?
Well, sometimes it happens like this. There are enough accounts and descriptions from different individuals that sometimes it happens like this. It doesn't have to happen like this. You know, there aren't any rules here.
Yeah,
and what we're describing, what other individuals describe, is a kind of sudden awakening. And of course, awakening can be gradual as well. It doesn't have to be sudden. But quite often, individuals do report, let's say, two separate events. And just for the purpose of description, I call one of these, the first one, awakening. And awakening is, if it happens like this, it's like a sudden seeing of the complete emptiness of everything. And when I say everything, I mean both this and that. And so it's seeing that this and that are completely empty. It's also seeing that they're the same. There is no this or that, because there's just emptiness. And I mean, the Buddhists are very, very good at describing the emptiness of all phenomena. They talk about empty phenomena rolling by. But to see that, and often that seeing might just be literally for a split second or a half second, can be a tremendous shock. And what often happens is that after that momentary seeing of emptiness, the person comes back. And they're likely to come back in a very confused state, not really understanding what's happening or what's happened, but feeling that something momentous has happened.
So it's not liberated.
It's not liberation.
Maybe even frustrated.
It's what tends to happen after that. It doesn't have to be like this, but what tends to happen after that is there's a lot of frustration and a lot of despair. Because what often happens is that the seeker, the one who feels separate and is seeking, comes back. But because of that glimpse of nothingness, they know that there is now nothing they can do about their dilemma. So they still want to seek. They still feel incomplete, but they know that there is no way of seeking which will be effective. So that often leads to despair.
It sounds a little bit like Kermit suddenly seeing that he's just a puppet, and that he's played and he can't do anything about it. We're just Jim Henson or Jim Beam.
Yeah.
We'll just do whatever he does.
That's a good metaphor. Yeah. It's a good metaphor, yeah. And so you could say, before this flash, if that's what happens, the seeker has hope that they can find. And after the flash, they no longer have hope, they have despair. Mm-hmm. They still want to find, but now there's despair. And sometimes I say that despair is I mean, it's just a metaphor in a way, but sometimes I say that despair is a lot closer to what we're talking about than hope is.
Really? Like
absolutely.
No hopelessness. Everything
absolutely.
Has no hope, and this is closer.
It's much closer
than
to this.
Hope itself.
In a way, it is, and I get a lot of emails from people. I talk to people on the phone. People come to my meetings, and many people have said to me the same thing. They've said there's been a sudden seeing, and it's left them in despair. And they honestly do say, person after person has said to me, and it's such a relief. It's such a relief to be in despair, to be able to give up hope.
Because somebody who was waiting was his death, he's sentenced to death, and he knows no way out, and then the mind quiets down.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, because the thing about hope is a very hard taskmaster. It's very difficult to relax when there's hope, because there's always something that you need to be doing. At least with despair, there's the possibility of some relaxation taking place. And there is no key to what we're talking about, but if there was a key, it would be to relax. I mean, I don't have any advice, but if I did have advice, it would be to relax. And of course, the reason that I don't give that advice is because there's no one who can relax. But if relaxation should happen, then that's a great blessing.
If there's no why, who's the one looking and perceiving if it is not the I? Because it seems like something is looking, something is experiencing. Is it just like a stone is a stone without a stoner? Is it just experience without an experiencer?
Yes.
Is it life the experiencer?
I think that's the best way to describe it. Yes, there's experience.
Yes.
But no separate experiencer. Yeah, well, any answer to this is going to be abstract, it's going to be a bit philosophical, it's not really going to hit it, but we could say oneness is experiencing itself.
Yeah.
There's no one experiencing it, there's just experience. In a sense that this idea, there's someone experiencing this, is actually a very clear statement of separation. That's what it feels like to be separate. There's the experiencer, and then there's experience. And the experiencer feels they can interact with experience and change it. So it's the collapse of that we're talking about. The recognition that there is no separate experiencer. I mean, how we could describe it, we could say, there is just this, and what this consists of is whatever phenomena are happening.
Yeah.
So movement, sound, perception, thought going through, sensation, and within that, one of the phenomena may be the sense that all of the other phenomena are happening for a separate person. So it's that that collapses. It's that one extra phenomena that all the other things are happening for a separate person that collapses. That's, if you like, what dies.
Well, but I often hear the term "you are awareness" and everything arises from awareness. Could it be that awareness itself is also just a manifestation, like just another appearance? And or is it? Some people refer to awareness as it would be that. As it would be, awareness is God or something.
Yes,
like
yes.
That, but yeah. It is understood like this.
It's a tricky word. I mean, I use the word awareness and consciousness sometimes simply to try to explain or describe certain aspects of what I'm talking about, but they're tricky words. Some people like to avoid them entirely, and I quite understand that. So if by using the word awareness or consciousness or something like that, if that is heard as meaning there is something separate which is experiencing this, so there's experience and then there's the awareness of experience, and awareness is something somehow outside that, and maybe that is what God is or whatever. No, forget that. Forget it. It's just the kind of tangle that words get us involved in. So if I use the word awareness or consciousness, it's only in the sense, if you like, of describing the absolutely obvious, which is, I've already just said, that, you know, certain phenomena are happening. This hand is moving, this sound is being made, perhaps there's a sensation, these are phenomena. If I use the word awareness or consciousness, it's only in the sense that those phenomena are happening, they're known, it's known that they're happening. Who knows that they're happening? No one knows that they're happening.
I rather like the word existence or aliveness than awareness.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, the traditional, one of the traditional definitions of this, or one of the traditional descriptions of this from the yogic tradition, is Satchitananda, and I mean we could translate that in various ways, but the translation that I like is energy, consciousness, and of course Ananda. Well, that's tricky. Unconditional love, I would use the phrase unconditional love. Well, two of those things I would say are absolutely obvious. It's obvious that there's energy, because if there wasn't energy, nothing would be happening.
Yeah.
And it's obvious that there's consciousness, because without consciousness, even if there was something happening, it wouldn't be known that it's happening.
Yeah.
And then the unconditional love, perhaps that's a big one. Let's leave that aside for now. We'll come back to it if we want to. But you see, having said that, I'm not suggesting now that we now have in non-duality three different things, energy and consciousness and unconditional love. It's not that. It's just that happens to be the nature of this manifestation, is that there's energy and there's stuff happening apparently, and it's known that this stuff is happening.
You said that recognizing that there's no person can lead to despair, but you don't seem to be in much despair. So I would like to talk about, I read your book, and I read that you had an experience where you've seen that everything is empty.
Yes.
And then another experience where we've seen that everything is full.
Yes, we forgot to add that, didn't we? Now, it's interesting that you brought that up just after I've mentioned unconditional love, which is a big phrase, and anyway, yes, so after that initial seeing, which sometimes happens like that for some individuals and sometimes leaves them in despair, there can then be another seeing. And this other seeing is like the first seeing, in that emptiness is seen, the non-existence of the self is seen, the emptiness of the self is seen, and this time what is seen is that everything is not only empty but it's also full. And it's seeing the fullness of everything which generally brings an end to despair and brings an end to searching, and after that there's just life happening. After that there's simply whatever is happening, and that, if you like, you know, that could be said to be, you know, that is the end of searching, the absolute end of searching. There's no possibility of searching after that. And I'm very fond of quoting a little bit of Nisargadatta about this. I think he had something wonderful and very brief to say about this. He said, seeing nothing is wisdom, and seeing I am nothing is wisdom, and seeing I am everything is love. And that first seeing is seeing I am nothing, and it brings a kind of wisdom because it brings an end to all of the stories that we have about meaning and purpose and what life is about. It turns out that life isn't about anything. Life is simply life. It doesn't have to be about anything. And Nisargadatta says, seeing I am nothing is wisdom. I mean, I could put it in a different way. I would say that what seeing I am nothing brings about is an end to stupidity. So it's not that we gain wisdom, it's that we lose stupidity because we no longer follow all of these insane stories about what life is about. It's about pleasing God, or it's about this, or it's about that. It's a path with a goal at the end of it. All of that stops. But, of course, the suffering separate person is still there. And what Nisargadatta goes on to say then, he's talking about this seeing of fullness, this second seeing, as it might be, it doesn't have to be like that, but the second seeing where it's seen that I am love because everything is love. It's not I am love, it's that everything is love and I and everything are one. And that's what he describes as fullness. And that's what I referred to a little hesitantly before when I was mentioning Satchitananda, that we have energy, we have consciousness, we have unconditional love.
Yeah, well, it's so weird. Like, for example, mobbing in school or at work. Why do people do that? Looking down at others, mocking them? Also, why? It seems absurd that one is just doing that to himself, kind of. I'd be glad if you shared your thoughts on that.
No, you are not going to get me to share my thoughts on that, because there are no intelligent thoughts to be shared about it. In a way, all I can say, you know, the world is whatever it is. We all know what the world of separation is like.
Yeah.
We know what the waking dream is like. When somebody like me sits in a chair like this and says, you know, and it's unconditional love, it can sound like the inanity and the insanity of some blissed out hippie who's been smoking too much ganja. There is no way of, there is no way in which the mind can be satisfied with that statement. You know, it's all unconditional love. What's the mind going to do with that? All the mind can do with that is say, well, it certainly doesn't look like it to me.
Yeah, it looks like war and like corruption.
Exactly.
And like all these stories.
So,
politicians.
So the, and So the one who's sitting here, or other individuals sitting in other seats in other rooms talking about this, in a sense, I mean, we are engaging in a hopeless task here. We are trying to describe the indescribable, or F the ineffable. And in the end, all that I or anyone else can say is it's simply seen. This, the nature of this is unconditional love. And if the mind doesn't like it, the mind will argue with it. And if the mind argues with it, the mind will always win. But it's winning on, if you like, a level, a mental level, a cognitive level, which has no bearing here.
Is it possible for the search to drop away without the person to drop away, or seen through. It seems like there are some people in the world who don't have any interest about spirituality or non-duality, and still there's more dedication to life itself than to any gods in the future anymore.
Yeah, well, there aren't any rules. I would say that separation tends to induce a feeling of dissatisfaction. It's a kind of contraction, and there's a sort of tightness about it which is dissatisfying. So it tends to produce a feeling that, well, this isn't quite it. Somehow I've got to do something to make it it. And I mean, searching might take the form of seeking for a better car, or seeking for a better partner, or seeking for a better house, or whatever. But what you've described is certainly also true. There certainly also seem to be individuals who simply, as it were, live comfortably with themselves, in themselves, or whatever. There are absolutely no rules about this, as I said before. And one of the things that happens, I think sometimes separation, if you like, separation out into this contracted state never fully happens. Sometimes seeing through separation happens at a very young age. It happens to the child, and then that's never quite forgotten. And that can certainly can produce a kind of an orientation towards the world where there isn't that kind of tense and contracted seeking that drives us neurotically on. It's certainly possible. I think there are cases where no form of separation really ever took place. So the individual really always lives, as it were, with the knowing of what we're talking about. And I mean, I can't be certain about this. I don't think anyone can be certain about it. But I suspect that if you look at the descriptions of J.J. Krishnamurti when he was very young, I think he was about 8 years old when the Theosophists found him and adopted him as their pet.
He became the Buddha.
Well, they were going to make him the Buddha,
yeah.
The Maitreya, when they adopted him as their pet avatar, as it were. If you read descriptions of what he was like at 8 years old, it seems to me that separation was never there. So I think that's entirely possible. It's probably quite rare, but it's entirely possible. For this kind of contraction simply not to take place.
But don't you lose all ambition when the person drops away? Because if everything is happening by itself and has no meaning anymore, wouldn't everybody just refuse to work, sit down and just smile or something like that?
There's two different questions there. In terms of somebody once said to me in a talk I was giving, they said, well, it would be terrible if I saw this, they said, because then I wouldn't get up in the morning and go to work anymore. And I said, well, you know, do you like living in a house? And he said, yes, I like living in a house. We said, well, do you want to pay your mortgage? Yeah, I want to pay your mortgage. Well, in that case, you know, you'll probably get up and go on going to work. So in practical terms, this may make absolutely no difference. However, what you first started with, yes, that is very commonly reported, that when even there's even been a glimpse of this, that kind of glimpse of emptiness that we were talking about earlier, yes, you're absolutely right that the person, the individual, may then find that their ambition reduces greatly, that their ambition may die completely, or it may reduce greatly. And I'm contacted by many, many individuals, and they say, well, I really want to do, Richard, is I just want to sit around and, well, sit around full stop, or maybe sit around and read or go for little walks or so. There is certainly a truth in that. This is not a teaching and it's not instrumental. But nevertheless, I would say, you could say that you could say that seeing this tends to produce a huge increase in a very, very important virtue, and a virtue which is extremely underrated and which we do not talk about enough, and that is the virtue of laziness.
Yeah.
And now, if anybody wants to challenge me about whether laziness is a virtue or not, I would simply say, well, just consider one thing. Think of all the mischief that is done in the world that would not be done if only people were a bit lazier. Because they couldn't be bothered to do all that mischief. So I think it's at least worth considering that mischief is a profound virtue. But I don't really want to bring morality into this talk anyway, because I don't think morality has any place here anyway. But I just notice that even a glimpse of this can produce a substantial increase in laziness. And we can decide for ourselves whether that's a good thing, a bad thing, or a neutral thing.
Mm-hmm.
I myself am extremely lazy.
Yeah, me too, sometimes. And it feels good if it's allowed. Usually, before I tended to feel like, oh my God, I'm bad, I shouldn't be lazy, but now it's just okay.
Yeah, we're back to... Go back to what I said earlier, there is no method, but if there were a method, it would be to relax.
Sometimes you point out that time is an illusion. What can you say about time and how come it's an illusion? I mean, we make appointments like this interview, for example, we measure time for sport, we can measure time, we grow old, there seems no doubt that time is real. What can you say about that? How can time not be real?
Again, this is very frustrating for the mind. In a way, we're talking about something which is simply seen, and it's not seen or understood by the mind. You know, in the seeing that we're talking about, it's seen that space is unreal, time is unreal, and yet, as you just said, you know, we made an appointment yesterday or the day before to have this meeting today. So there is an appearance of time. Time appears, if you like, time appears in consciousness, to use that word again. In actuality, there is just, you know, I hope that what I'm going to say now is actually stunningly obvious. I hope it is. In actuality, there is just this.
Now.
Well, it's not even now. I mean, now suggests duration. There is literally just this. So there's no past, no future,
if you like. Not the now on a timeline, but the eternal. Yeah, this you could say.
Yeah, you could say that. You could say there is eternity, and eternity means outside time. And in eternity, which is outside time, the dream of time arises. The dream of time appears. So there is no doubt that I feel quite sure that the three of us sitting in this room have an awareness of time having passed, that we started this interview, before that we had a cup of tea, and that time has passed. And also, is it not stunningly obvious also that this is it? That this is it, that there is nothing existent before this or after this, and even to use the terms before this and after this are absurd. Isn't that kind of
a container for everything that happens?
Yeah.
As a picture, if you will.
You could say, I would say, kind of stunningly obvious, and at the same time, it makes no sense to the mind whatsoever, because the mind lives in time.
Yeah. And even space is non-existent, there's nothing left.
It's so frustrating for the mind, but even in that split second of seeing that may occur, it's seen that, I'm going to use this phrase, it's quite misleading, but I can't think of a different phrase to use, that awareness is everywhere, and therefore there is no everywhere. Because to the separated person, it feels like awareness is coagulated or concentrated here, and outside here there is space, there's a world that this can move around in. So there is space. Space obviously exists. But even a split second of seeing reveals that there is no awareness here, which is not over there. There is simply awareness. It's the same awareness everywhere, so there isn't any everywhere.
And it couldn't be that this is still an experience inside the body.
It's not an experience. It's again, language breaks down here, but it's not an experience. Or the The description I use is it's not an experience, because for me an experience is something that happens for a person. So when the person isn't there, I call it an event, because we have to use a word, and you or anybody listening to this may think I'm splitting hairs, but I'm just still struggling to describe the indescribable. I would say this is not an experience. Anyone who, like me, became a spiritual seeker may have had many spiritual experiences which they may relate to what we're talking about. I would say they have no relation to what we're talking about. This has nothing to do with a spiritual experience.
Is it the same with cause and effect as with time and space?
Exactly,
like,
the same.
Because when a hand touches a hot plate, it gets burned. It doesn't seem like you could ever touch it without getting burned.
Yeah.
This seems like kind of a law, like cause and effect, like hot plate plus hand means ow.
Yeah, of course.
So this is how it arises, but still there's no cause and effect, no real.
Again, I find the only way of talking even remotely coherently about this is to go back to the metaphor of a nighttime dream and to this being a waking dream. So of course in the story of the waking dream, just as in a nighttime dream, cause and effect happen. Of course they do. It's absurd to say they don't. And when it's seen that the dream is a dream, then that simply collapses. Okay, so I don't know if this will make sense, but let's spend a few seconds on it. So in a nighttime dream, if anybody thinks about the last nighttime dream that they could remember, there was space and time in it, probably it took place, certainly it would have taken place over a certain amount of time, they probably moved around in it or existed somewhere, so there was space, and almost certainly in that nighttime dream there would have been cause and effect. Perhaps they went to a railway station and bought a ticket for a train ride, and they were given a ticket, and then they got onto a train and the train started moving through time and space. And perhaps because it's a dream, an elephant came in and sat down on the seat next to them and started talking to them, maybe. So there's time, space, cause and effect all happening in the nighttime dream. Now the moment that the dreamer wakes up from that dream in the morning, from the nighttime dream in the morning, it's known that none of those things have any reality. There was no time, there was no space, there was no ticket, there was no train, there certainly wasn't any talking elephants. It's only a metaphor.
This feels more real.
Of course it does.
I know when I dream, and I'm really convinced that what happens,
yes.
then there's actually the feeling of frustration, anger, maybe even pain or fear, and it seems pretty real. And of course, it's just when I'm waking up, then it was just a dream. But this, then, you kind of wake up to a new dream. You could say that
exactly.
Feels even more real.
Yeah, but as you said, in the nighttime dream feels absolutely real while we're in it. The moment we wake up from it, it's known to be unreal. Now, of course, waking up from a nighttime dream is the death of the one who was in the nighttime dream. So what we're talking about here, we're not talking about waking up from this waking dream. Waking up from this waking dream is physical death. What we're talking
about. Oh, wow. Nobody wants that.
What we're talking about here, and there's a very good book by a Dutch writer about this called Awakening to the Dream. Leo Harting, his name is. What we're talking about here is awakening to the dream. In other words, we're waking up to the fact that this is, in a way, a waking dream. It's real and it's unreal.
Oh.
It's both. And one metaphor that's used is that awakening or liberation or whatever you want to call it, it's kind of the equivalent of, in a nighttime dreaming, what's called lucid dreaming.
Oh.
Because lucid dreaming at night, the dream goes on, but the dreamer becomes aware that it is a dream. So that's quite a good metaphor. The other thing I'd like to add in terms of what what you said. Of course, this does seem utterly, well, it doesn't seem, it is utterly convincing. A nighttime dream is also utterly convincing. But the difference, the main difference, I would suggest, between a nighttime dream and this waking dream is that this waking dream is a great deal more consistent. It has a lot more consistency than a nighttime dream.
Yeah.
And one way of putting this, you could say, is that every night we go to sleep and we go to sleep into a different dream, but every morning we wake up and we wake up into the same dream every morning. And it's really, it's the consistency of this dream that makes it so utterly, utterly convincing. But also notice, because some people do use the word illusion about this, notice I'm not saying that this isn't real. At no point have I said this isn't real. I may be using the metaphor of a waking dream, but I haven't said that it's not real. It is real. Of course it's real. If the word real means anything, this is as real as it gets. This cup of tea is as real as it gets. But it's also unreal. It's not one or the other, it's both.
It's like we are in core, we are nothing, playing everything or playing something.
Yeah.
Playing different people.
Yeah. So. Yeah, some people attack this kind of communication by saying, oh, it's saying that this is unreal, that it's an illusion, I mean, there's nothing here that has ever said this is unreal. Whether we call it an illusion or not, that's a bit more difficult because people use that word illusion in different ways. What an illusion is it's something that is different to what it appears to be. And in that sense, this is an illusion because it is different to what it ordinarily appears to be. But it's not an illusion in the commonly thought sense that it's unreal, that it doesn't exist. Of course it exists. It both exists and it doesn't exist. And if the mind can't understand that, it's kind of, well, tough on the mind. The mind will never understand the mind might understand what we're talking about, but it will never see what we're talking about.
Well, it can strengthen the feeling of searching. I want this too.
Yes.
I want what you have.
Sure. I don't have anything.
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the great mistakes about this that the mind makes. Oh, that this is something that can be gained. It's not something that can be gained. I don't have anything. What we're talking about here is a loss. It's not a gain. It's simply a loss. It's the loss of the sense that there was ever a person who did anything.
Ouch. But also, yay.
That's a very good way of putting it, both ouch and yay. Yeah. Yeah.
Many humans dream of the possibility that there will still be life after death. Is there a possibility for rebirth? I mean, look, if everything is one energy, and energy is just changes but doesn't leave, couldn't that mean that we transform into a new life form after death?
I am going to say that seeing what we're talking about, right, puts an end to questions about death. It doesn't put an end to questions about death because it answers them. It puts an end to these questions because it is absolutely and totally seen that they are unanswerable. And once even the mind, which is possibly the most stupid part of us, as well as also the most intelligent part of us, even the mind loses interest in questions once it is really got, it is really seen that these questions are unanswerable. So all sorts of what I'm going to call metaphysical questions, not just about death, but about other things as well. Angels, perhaps, or rebirth, karma, dharma, we don't even, I mean, let's not list all the metaphysical questions that the mind might get tangled up in. What tends to happen is that once it's seen that these questions are simply unknowable, the mind just gets bored with them and loses interest and goes, oh, who cares? I mean, really, life after death, who cares? And I started off quite early on referring to mystics and saying, you know, there's not very much that mystics know. I mean, all that mystics really know is there is no self, and the nature of this is unconditional love. Now, the other thing that mystics know is that almost everything else is unknowable. And once it's got that this stuff is unknowable,
yeah,
well, who cares? We just lose interest.
But they had, like, these wisdom, these wise people that know everything, like the mystery men of the mountain. You go, and every question will be answered, but it's not the
wisdom. The wisdom of the mystic lies in the fact that they know almost nothing. And that most things are unknowable. So, you know, why bother? Have another cup of tea.
Yeah,
who cares? Have another cup of tea.
In the story, do you see an evolution towards the liberation of all beings or humans or body-mind mechanisms? Like, sometimes from a certain point of view, it seems like this whole non-duality thing is a virus going, and with the new possibilities like internet and stuff, it's spreading more widely than ever.
That's a lovely story, isn't it?
A lovely story, yes. I just want to...
No, because there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
I mean, they're lovely stories. I mean, I began my spiritual search many years ago, a few decades ago, with transcendental meditation. And there was this wonderful idea, wasn't there, the coming age of enlightenment. It's a lovely, beautiful and somewhat addictive story for the mind. I mean, the mind loves two different opposing stories, depending on the nature of the mind. Some minds love the story that everything is getting worse and worse and worse, and we're all going to hell in a handcart, and there'll be some terrible apocalypse. Some minds just love that, and other minds love the idea that we're moving towards a shift in planetary consciousness,
yeah,
and a coming age of enlightenment. Well, and meanwhile, this simply goes on being this. This is all there is, and it just goes on being this in whatever way it manifests.
Another story that where we could say, put that story away and let's have a cup of tea.
Yeah, I mean, the separated mind, the one who lives in separation, often seeks for meaning and purpose. You know, they feel bereft if they don't have meaning and purpose in life. And it could be any meaning or purpose, really, and that is one of them. You know, I'm working to usher in the coming age of enlightenment or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, I've met people, I've asked them what they do, they say, I'm a light worker. I'm here to bring increasing light to the planet. It doesn't seem to me that the planet needs increasing light. It seems that the sun is quite capable of giving off quite sufficient light to it. But it's so painful to live in separation that the one who lives in separation can often only find it bearable if they create this story about a meaning or a purpose, and we're moving towards some beautiful state in the future. Healing the planet, it might be. Helping to raise the consciousness of everyone. These are lovely ideas.
Yeah.
They're beautiful, they're lovely, and they're meaningless.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, there is just this. Isn't that kind of obvious?
Yeah.
Really?
And it happens, whatever will happen.
And what happens...
It does.
What apparently happens, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Apparently happens brings me to one of the last questions I have. There's this term, nothing ever happened. Can you say something about that? Even if there's no I, there's holding this apparent paper where I have the questions, yes, kissing, and some things that happen have such an amount of energy, like sex, for example, people would never say nothing happened. So what does it mean, that nothing ever happened?
There's nothing that more that we can say about that that will make any sense to the mind. You know, when this is seen through, it's seen that there is no time and there is no space. Without time and space, nothing can ever happen. There is only this, right? And unless physical death occurs at the same time as that seeing, this waking dream continues. And in this waking dream, plenty of stuff happens, including sex, thank God. So, again, in a way, maybe the best thing to say about this is to go back to that traditional metaphor of the nighttime dream, or the modern version of that metaphor of the cinema film. In a nighttime dream, plenty happens, including maybe sex. In a film that we're watching in the cinema, plenty happens, almost certainly sex if it's a modern film. You see, so there's lots and lots happening, there's masses of stuff happening, and yet it's perfectly possible also to say, from the position of the one who recognises that it's a nighttime dream, that nothing actually happens, and equally the one sitting in the cinema knows full well, really, they may have suspended their disbelief, but they know full well that actually nothing happened. And those actors, I'm afraid to say, most of the time, didn't actually have sex on screen, although occasionally they might.
Yeah, once you said enlightenment is or awakening is a little bit like the lights go on in the cinema and you see, yes, I'm in the cinema, and you lose the feeling that what you just saw is any reality whatsoever.
Although in a way we could say, with that metaphor, to expand it, of course, you know, in awakening it's seen that I am, if you like, I am the cinema itself. I am the audience, I am the screen, I'm the characters on the screen, I am the projector and the light from the projector, and the film running through the projector, I am everything. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe the best part of that metaphor, I don't know if that's confusing, if this is confusing, might be to say, you know, what I mostly am is the light in the projector, the light coming from the projector, and then the film goes through it. And it turns that pure white light of being into the manifestation. I mean, one of the metaphors I've used, and I'm sure
was watching the movie.
That as well. That as well. Everything. One of the metaphors I've used, and I'm sure many other people have used this metaphor as well, is that you could say, in a way, this is a prism. This, you know, the mind, the psychophysical organism, is a prism. You know, and you have the pure white light of being, and it hits the prism. And then the prism splits it up into the colours of the rainbow. I mean, that is only a metaphor. If it's confusing, then for goodness sake, let's throw it in the waste bin.
But favourite ones. But it's so weird. That means that basically when everything is energy, everything is God, then God plays people praying to God. And desperately,
I've never said that everything is God.
Oh,
I tend to avoid that language. I think it can be misleading. There is just oneness. You know, people ask, well, why? Why is this happening? Why questions always invite a story? There's no possibility of answering a why question without making up a story about it. But of all the stories that are made up about, well, why is this happening, the one I like most, the one that appeals to me most, is the one from the game, from the yogic tradition, that says, well, this is Leela. It's a play. This is the play of consciousness.
Yeah. In a way, if I want to ask, if I ask a question, and I want this question answered, there's the I already that wants the answer. Who wants to know? I. And it's creating the I again, in a way. Yeah. Well, my last question is, a little bit absurd after all this talk, but still, if someone would ask you, please, Richard, I want to be more happy and live a more fulfilling life, please tell me what to do. What would your answer be?
Well, one probable answer is I don't give advice, and I hope it's obvious why I don't give advice.
Yeah.
Another answer I might give is, you know, being happier and living a more fulfilling life has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is not about being happy, and it's not about being fulfilled. If oneness is seen, if non-duality is seen through, there may be more happiness, there may not be. There may be more fulfillment, there may not be. I mean, one of the wisest things ever said about this is in the Zen saying that almost everybody who's interested in this knows, before liberation, chop wood. After liberation, chop wood. In other words, this doesn't necessarily make any difference. This isn't about happiness or fulfillment. It's about seeing that there is no one who experiences any of that.
Yeah.
But going back to the person who asked that question, probably in the end, I would say, look, if there's anything you can do to relax, then relax. If there's some small, simple thing that you enjoy doing, do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not advice, but, you know, why not? You know, why not? If it's possible to relax, why not relax? If mm-hmm. there's some small, simple thing you enjoy doing, like walking around a lake or having a cup of coffee or going to see your girlfriend or your boyfriend, well, why not? It's not very profound, is it, I'm afraid?
Yes, and then it will happen what will happen.
And then,
as it always does,
what happens is exactly what happens, always and absolutely without fail, I guarantee it. I mean, this is the one thing I can say more absolutely than anything else, that what happens is what happens. And if that sounds staggeringly banal, yeah, all I feel I can do is to profoundly apologise on behalf of oneness for saying that.
Okay, I think that's all. Thank you for your time and answers, Richard. It was a pleasure seemingly meeting you.
Thank you. Thank you, and thank you for the tea.
Yeah, no problem. Have a nice day in Berlin.
Thank you.